Hello, Dr. Bernard here. This is an interview with Christopher East, who is maybe one of two or three people who are documented to have survived an accident with 2,4-dinitrophenol, a weight loss chemical. His case was published in Literature, and I also made a video about it with parts of this interview in there. Christopher is also a YouTuber as well, and he has a channel where he also talks about his case, link in the description below.
So I'm going to roll the ad now so that the rest of this episode is uninterrupted.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Well, I guess we can just start. Chris, thanks so much for coming into the interview. Can you tell me a little bit more about yourself? I saw your video about DNP, and I wanted to know a little bit more about you.
My name is Christopher East. I run a relatively new YouTube channel. I started creating content because I've gone through a lot of unique and hard situations in my life, and I think there's lessons to be learned or like things to take away from that. So I started just taking these experiences that have been rather difficult for me, ranging from overdose to other things, but especially with my overdose, people talking about their experiences of it being safe or them being fine. But the difficult thing with an overdose, especially something like DNP, is that those that pass away, once you get into that territory of danger, there's no real coming back. And so I have a really unique perspective of someone who's actually managed to survive an overdose, and I thought that'd be an interesting experience to share.
So can you tell me a little bit more about how you got into lifting in general? Because I think we all have those stories of, like back when we were in school with our friends in the weight room and trying to see like how much each other can lift, right? How did you first get into the weight room and fitness?
Most of middle school, I was pretty much bullied relentlessly for a variety of things. I was kind of on the shorter side, still to say kind of short. I was overweight, very nerdy, didn't have a lot of friends. And so I was bullied for a lot of things all throughout middle school, a little bit in elementary school. And then that transition period between middle school and high school, I took a summer school. And that's where you could just basically take some of these extracurricular classes. But I took a weightlifting class for football. Now, in eighth grade, I was in football, but I was absolutely terrible. I was afraid to hit anyone. I wasn't particularly strong, wasn't particularly fast. And so I went into the weight room and I absolutely fell in love with lifting weights. And at the time, it was just something fun to do. It was nice to be around a bunch of people that I saw as popular or likable. And it was interesting because I really fell into loving weights, but what really solidified it for me, going back into high school as a completely different person, I came into ninth grade and no one recognized me. I looked radically different. I was all of a sudden starting in the freshman football team. And so I went from this person that had no friends, very unlikable, very out of shape, and I was starting to really grow into my body through weightlifting. And that sense of relief of going into high school on a radically different page of where I was in middle school. And for me, weightlifting saved me from bullying. It saved me from being an outcast. I was by no means ever particularly popular, but I went from being kind of on the bottom rung of, school hierarchy to all of a sudden being at least in the middle of the pack.
Yeah, I had a similar situation when I was in high school because I was always kind of a little bigger kid. And I think I was almost 200 pounds when I was in sixth grade. And so when I was a junior year, summer to junior year of high school, I had a group of friends come up to me and they said, "Hey, Bernard, why don't you come to the gym with us?" And I think they were trying to make fun of me because they were just like, "Oh, haha, Bernard's the fat kid. Let's see how much he can lift. I bet you he can't lift as much as us." And so I remember the first time I bench pressed, we put the 135s on the one plates and I was able to do it for reps and they were like, "What? How do you do that?" And then looking back on it now, I'm still friends with those guys. They're like the one group of friends that I've kept in touch with. And they're, the one guy has such long arms, like it was no wonder why he couldn't bench 135, right? But he could deadlift crazy amounts, right? So it was always a little bit of a perspective there. And so now when you got into the gym, What was your perspective on lifting up until, you know, the, like, throughout high school and into the end of high school?
Well, lifting was this double-sided thing where it was honestly just like a source of being able to, like, make friends and, like you talked about, becoming ultra competitive about pushing your body. Because, like, growing up, I was always, you know, like, in challenge classes, and I always valued myself for my mind, but having weightlifting all of a sudden gave me this new avenue to see value in myself through, you know, pushing my body, getting very strong. And it was crazy because this ultra competitiveness and then also wanting to do well in football, you know, I got into these crazy places where, like, I think my max squat in high school was like something like 500 pounds. My max bench was 315. And so it's crazy because 16-year-old me is way stronger than I've ever been since. So weightlifting was really this way to all of a sudden open all these doors for me that I never really thought was possible. And I really fell in love with weightlifting through up until junior year of high school, when a lot of things in my life changed.
So you were the guy who could squat the 5 plates and, like, you know, I remember I was going to play football. I got kicked out after the 2-a-days, summer to senior year. Yeah. And it was funny because I was a senior and I remember getting tackled by people on the JV team and just, like, getting knocked out. And I'm just like, what am I doing? Right. And I thought I was, you know, like, I could bench 185, you know. There were those guys who could squat like 5 or 6 plates, and, like, everyone in the gym would just, like, gather around them. Right. It was just awesome. Right. You had mentioned that there was an event that happened at high school and then also into college.
In the very tail end of my junior year in high school, a month before my 17th birthday, my father tragically passed away from a sudden heart attack. It was completely unexpected. You know, one morning he's fine, I go to school, the next thing I know I'm getting pulled out of school and my father's gone. And I'll probably get into it later, but I really blamed myself for the death of my father. But his sudden passing threw me into this realm of, you know, kind of pain and loss that I didn't really understand. I also have 6 siblings, so it was such a massive loss for not only me, but my entire family. And the second that happened, everything else didn't really matter to me anymore. Like, the way my body looked didn't matter. All of a sudden, chasing these things, like, in high school, we had these different clubs for you would combine your squat, your deadlift, and your bench. And you would chase these massive clubs of the 1,000-pound club. And things that I used to really care about, like, you know, all these things just fell away. And not only did they fall away, not only did I no longer care about football and weightlifting and being competitive, because all those things seemed so abstract now and couldn't even begin to replace the loss of my father. And so the next thing that happened is I started binge eating to try to fill that void. I really turned to food to cope. And within the first year, so finishing out high school, I had gained roughly between 60 and 80 pounds. And because I wasn't taking football as seriously or weightlifting, I just naturally fell into this place where I was gaining all this weight. And it was difficult because, you know, moving from middle school, I had this conception of myself as unfit. And then I really earned this identity of being someone who's in shape and athletic. And everyone saw me in high school as this really buff kid. And so it was hard to see that weight gain. I didn't really notice that I was gaining weight. I didn't really notice that I wasn't fitting into my clothes. And anytime I did notice, I didn't particularly care. And so by the time I started my freshman year of college, I had gained over 100 pounds. I think at my heaviest, I was about 254, 260. And, you know, I was about 170 in high school. You know, I'm in college and it's difficult because there's all these things happening. Something I touch upon in my video where I talk about the experience. In high school, everyone understood me as, like, the really buff kid that got, you know, overweight because of the death of his father. But the second I moved across the country and went to school in Florida, I'm from Indiana. And my freshman year, everyone just saw me as one of the fat guys. In fact, there was this comment that was made to me. It was this aha moment at how much weight I had gained. One of the other people who were overweight on my, like, dorm room floor, he kind of made this remark to me. He was like, "Oh, Chris, you're one of the fat guys." And it wasn't the fact he called me fat that bothered me. It was that sudden realization that these people don't know me as anyone other than overweight. And they also don't know what caused that weight gain. They don't understand that I lost my dad. Because in my school, because I had so many siblings, like nearly every grade, even down to middle school, had heard about the passing of my father. And then, but in college, like no one knew. And so they only saw me in this rather limited context of being overweight. And so that was really difficult. But at the same time, I had this, you know, high school girlfriend. I moved across the country. It was really hard on both of us. And at that point, we had been dating for like a year and a half, 2 years. And she starts to cheat on me. And cheating in any context is difficult, but, you know, she cheated on me several times. And the thing that really kind of started to develop a body dysmorphic mindset is that not only, you know, were these people very lean, but they're also very tall and lanky and these kind of wiry frames. And even when I was in high school, like, I'm 5'8", I'm never going to be 6 foot. I'm always going to be a stocky guy. I'm always going to have some layer of muscle. And so it was really hard because not only had I gained all this weight and it made me feel like it was my fault, but these other guys that she was kind of cheating on me with looked so drastically different. And, you know, like, it's hard because I had just lost the death of my father and this was a girlfriend that knew my dad. And so I really clung on to that relationship and it was easy to make it feel like, oh, it's my fault because I'd also gained all this weight. I looked radically different than when her and I met. And so for me, it really became this thing of like, okay, this is my fault. And to earn my, to like keep my significant other, I have to lose that weight.
When I was in college too, I gained about 60 pounds in like a semester, right? There was the winter break of my freshman year. I went from 190 to 225, right? And that was, I remember my dad was the only time in my life my dad has ever cooked for me was during that winter break. And, you know, I would be drinking a gallon of milk. I would have the family size Stouffer's lasagna for dinner before going to, because I worked at like retail as a college kid, right? He would cook me eggs inside of like creamed corn as a soup with like chicken soup inside. And he was like, yeah, you got to eat up, you know, you got to get big. And so like I did get big. And then that second semester of my junior year, like I went from probably 220 to like 250. And everybody that I knew, because usually people don't transfer out halfway through the year. So people who knew me at the beginning of the year then saw this like, you know, 60, 70, 80 pound heavier Bernard, like the reaction to it was always different. So I guess my question to you is like, how much of an impact did like outside people have on your realization of, oh, you know, these people don't know my backstory. And now it almost seems like it feels like they're passing judgment on me when they're not really sure and they didn't know that previously things were different.
Well, I think in regards to how outside opinions affected me, like I said, I was so sheltered from the opinions of others in high school because, you know, who's going to make fun of the kid whose dad died? People aren't going to make that commentary. But the second that kind of bubble or protection is away, like I said, like from innocuous comments, like the person on my floor that said, you're one of us fat guys, like, he wasn't saying it to hurt me. He wasn't saying it to be rude. It was just like a companionship thing of like, oh, you're one of us. But I did face some other kind of comments. I remember the day I finally decided to lose weight. It's funny, I don't think I've ever told this story. I was in my like kind of like, you know, college cafeteria where like the Chick-fil-A and all this other stuff is at. And like I said, one of the difficult things is I wasn't really aware that I had gained this weight. I had still this previous conception of who I was. And I had a general idea that I was like starting to become really overweight. But like one of the side effects of that is like none of my clothes fit. I wasn't buying clothes that fit properly. And so I had this horrendous muffin top and someone in my cafeteria like across the way pointed at it and made fun of my muffin top, and I overheard it, and just this random girl, and which is just such a weird thing to say, but it was that moment that snapped me into this blinding clarity of like, oh my god, I'm 260 pounds. Like, how did I get here? Like, what happened? That was really the moment that shattered any kind of idea of me ever being lean. Like, that part of me or that identity of me really kind of died in that moment. And so it was difficult because I became suddenly so self-aware and so self-conscious.
Yeah, and it's that self-conscious, it like just kind of like bleeds into your mind and it doesn't stop. And it's like, you know, everything that you do, you almost feel like, well, this is what this person would say, or like, what are these people thinking? They're like, you know, you might walk by somebody. We can't walk by people now because of quarantine, but it's like, you know, you walk by somebody and then you look at the side of your eye, like, did they just look at me funny? Like, you know, did they pass judgment or something, right? And so, like, I remember that happening, too, on my end, too, because it was, like, the backlash I got from my family. They didn't see me for the whole semester, and then they come pick me up in May, and they're like, you're, like, 30 pounds heavier. And then they would actually rub it in. I tried to tell them, like I got bigger because I realized that at 6 feet tall, you know, if you wanted to compete with bigger weights, like, you would need to just have, like, a bigger frame in general.
Yeah.
And, you know, if my, like, natural body weight when I was, like, I don't know, 15, 16, like, you know, I ended up going down to around 165. It's a lot of work to get up, like, another 110 pounds from there. Yeah, Stouffer's lasagna, gallon milk every day. And then they weren't going to have it. And it was, like, every time I would go home, it just wouldn't stop. You had mentioned, right, like, once you had that clarity of self-awareness, like, things all of a sudden changed. So how did you get right back into fitness? How did you get back into that mindset?
The way I got back into fitness is to kind of touch on your previous point to launch into this new question. Something I talk about is that there's this interplay between being or our souls or our minds and body. And, you know, our bodies are these kind of unthinking things, and our beings are what kind of goes through the suffering and the anguish. And it's through that relationship, our bodies become often the embodiments of our pain. So for me, like, the death of my father became embodied in my body. Like, that was a direct trauma response, that all this binge eating and overeating and trying to cope with death with food. And it's difficult because my body changed, and I understood that relationship, and I understood what the extra weight was. But there's nothing about a body that conveys that naturally to someone, right? Like, You couldn't look at me in college like my peers. You wouldn't just look at me and see someone overweight because they lost their father. You think these other things. And because of our society, we have a propensity to make statements like, that person's lazy, that person doesn't have hard work. And it was kind of maddening because, like, not only had I been so fit and so crazy at 16, but now I was seen as this person who's overweight, and every single pound of body weight I had gained was intimately tied to my dad. And so for me, the way I got back into fitness, not only because of the, you know, my ex cheating on me, but I held this belief that to get over the death of my father was a manifold kind of thing I needed to tackle. But one of the most important ways to do it was to lose every single pound of body fat I had gained because of his death. And so it became this fixation that, like, the solution to my grief was to go through this, like, sort of hero's journey of, like, losing weight and kind of all these other things. And as I talked about earlier, I really blamed myself for the death of my father, because on the day he died, I knew something was wrong. He was showing all the classic signs of a heart attack. I have this kind of, you know, painful story of, we have this tradition of a handshake, and that morning he could barely grab my hand. And to that moment, despite every part of me screaming something is wrong, I chose not to say anything. I chose not to say anything because my dad and I were fighting, and I'm 16 and I'm rebellious, and I decided to be petty. And the next time I see my dad, he's on a hospital table, gone. And that was such a powerful and overwhelming feeling of blame, of replaying that moment again and again in my head. Like, what if I'd said this? What if I'd done this? Maybe I could have saved my dad. And so when it comes to fitness, it was this two-sided thing of, you know, trying to lose weight as this way of processing his death, and also losing weight to atone for the mistakes and the way I blamed my dad. But because I had this feeling of needing to redeem or atone, it was a lot of punishment. I needed to punish myself to achieve those things.
Like, going into fitness, you had mentioned that there was a little bit of a plateau that you had reached. And so what was the initial regimen like? Because did you go, like, directly into the mindset of, like, now, okay, starting tomorrow, 100%. The only thing I'm focused on now is getting as little body fat as possible. Was it like that, or was it more like, you know, as the weeks went on, it just started to really tighten into something that became that?
I think the process was just full bore immediately. One of the pros and cons of doing 4 years of weightlifting in high school, one of the reasons I was so strong in high school is because I had such an amazing athletic coach. We call Russell. Russell is a legend in our high school. We love him to death. But that man had such a meticulous program, and because of that, I really learned how to put on muscle quickly. I learned how to develop my own programs, and so all that skill, I jumped immediately back into the gym knowing what to do. But in combination with that, I went to school in Florida, so it's pretty warm year-round. I started taking up cycling, because I tried to run on the treadmill, but at 260 pounds, like, I wasn't burning enough calories because my body couldn't handle that weight. And so I decided to start cycling and road biking. This whole time, I developed binge eating disorder as a coping strategy when my dad passed. And all through my fitness, even kind of to this day, I struggle with binge eating. And so it was this difficult interplay of absolutely mercilessly destroying myself with 4 or 5 hour workouts, where I would go on like a 2 hour bike ride, I'd come back to the college gym and work out. But the whole time I was struggling with the eating aspect of it. So at 260 pounds, your body's so overweight that at first it's really easy, because, like, kind of no matter what you do, as long as you're putting some effort to it, you will start to lose weight. But because I was never really addressing the side effects of, you know, my poor diet and my overeating, it became more and more hard, even though I was doing these insane amounts of lifting. And the other kind of negative side effect is that it required me to make other sacrifices. Not only was it extremely painful, where my knees would hurt, my body would ache all the time because I was not giving myself rest, but it got to the point where I was starting to sabotage my academics. It's my freshman year of college. I'm going to school for aerospace engineering. I'm in flight school. I start skipping classes. I start putting all my attention into working out. And that was it was never a gradual thing. It was an immediate jump into that. And that's when I started kind of looking for ways to supplement that weight loss through supplements.
Got it. And so what were the supplements to begin with? Because, like, I know for me, when I was in the powerlifting gyms in Illinois back around like 2006, 2007, right, they always recommended, you know, oh, just creatine right now. And then as they get in, like, for the fat loss stuff, it depended on who you talked to, right, whether or not they would go with just green tea extract, or if they would go a little bit, you know, further. Yeah. So where did it start?
All through high school, my brother, who is also my oldest, youngest brother, if that makes sense, also got really into weightlifting. He's a year younger than me. We both got really strong at the same time. And so it's funny, because over those years, we must have bought every single kind of scam GNC product possible, from the crazy creatines to the test boosters that aren't even effective and all this other stuff. And I had all this experience of getting burned by normal supplements, right? Or just any kind of, like, out there supplements. So once again, when I went back into it, you know, I took, like, maybe beta-alanine for endurance, creatine, which is the normal protein. The only thing I really took for weight loss is I took, like, can't really remember the name. It was one of those, like, cut something. And in the beginning, that was effective. One of the downsides is I already struggled with a lot of anxiety. And anytime I took that, you know, supplement to help lose weight, I would have some pretty intense panic attacks, anxiety attacks. And so it was this interplay of, like, that's when the first kind of desperation where, even though it was having some awful side effects on me personally, I was starting to be willing to take, you know, anything that would help lose weight.
You know, that's interesting, because for me, I remember initially, like, I was a little bit hesitant with even just, like, creatine and protein powder. And then, like, you know, you kind of hit the plateau and you're like, all right, you know what? Why don't I try a scoop of this protein powder, right? And then then why don't I try a scoop of this, you know, creatine or whatever? And then, like, then all of a sudden it becomes, like, stacked up and you're taking, like, 5 different things, right? Like creatine and the citrulline malate was a thing back then, and beta-alanine, as you had mentioned. Yeah. And then I just remember, like, you know, even just for, like, day trips, you know, you have to bring like all these like plastic jugs with you in your car. And then like, you just have friends that are like looking at you like, what are you doing, man? And I'm just like, no, man, I got to take it.
Yeah. In high school and sophomore year, I would come with these lunch bags with, you know, all these different supplements, these like little pill things from like pressed creatine to fish oil, all this crazy stuff as a sophomore in high school. And twice I had teachers pull me aside and be like, what are in these lunch bags? And it's funny because, you know, one of the difficult things as this story progresses is the toll this has taken on my mom in particular. But the number of times my mom has gone to some, you know, random medical site because she saw we were taking a new supplement. I remember one time she printed out a 24-page document on how creatine is bad for your kidneys. And she was always trying to rally so firmly against us. But unfortunately, just with my family structure, especially my brother and I think to some way that pushed us harder into supplements as, you know, kind of a rebellious thing. There was some pretty crazy times where I was just taking like 8 different things at once. It was ridiculous.
And just to like reiterate for people watching, like, I mean, those aren't steroids, right? Because when I did my fat loss video, there were so many people saying like, oh yeah, you're taking steroids or whatever. Like, none of those are hormones. Like, they're like, creatine is something that your body actually makes. And by putting additional more, you're kind of giving it more ATP, so to say, right? More energy. Yeah. And it does help. I always felt like it really did more by like pushing water through into your muscles. And like that way, then you get like crazy pumps when you're first taking it. Like, you know, when you're in that loading phase, yeah, I think people used to take like, what, 20 grams a day for like the first week or something. And then like, basically you'd take down like the scoops and then you just like go to the bathroom like right away, just like just pee because like kidneys are flushing it out as hard as they can, right? You had mentioned T3. You had mentioned clenbuterol. You had mentioned DNP. So what was the transition from those GNC, you know, supplement store products into the kind of other things that they can help? Wouldn't recommend them, but, you know, it's like...
So I started losing weight. I set out on my, like, weight loss journey probably November of 2011. And so by a year's, roughly, like, 6 months by the end of my first year in college, I lost probably 30 to 40 pounds, and I decided to transfer back to a state school. I transferred to Purdue. I live in Lafayette, so it's right there. So I came back, and I lost 30 to 40 pounds, and everyone was commenting on it. Everyone was, like, making observations. Up until that point, I had all done it through, you know, abusive amounts of working out and then taking like, hydroxycut or something like that. Nothing extreme. A lot of my weight loss was really the fact I was dedicating 3 to 4 hours every day, just really pushing my body as hard as I could. And so I came back and then I hit this plateau. I hit this plateau at 220 and nothing I was doing was making a change. I was biking around 40 miles a day. But once again, like a common theme that I'm going to reiterate is I never addressed my eating. I never cleaned up my diet. I still struggle with binge eating. As I lost weight, there became these self-sabotaging mechanisms that would pop up where even though I was doing all this brutal stuff to my body, I was starting to like kind of try to sabotage that with my diet as well. So it's this two-pronged attack of having kind of what borders on an eating disorder and then also being inherently self-sabotaging. And it was in this plateau where no matter how much I was working out, no matter what I was doing, where I went to the internet to find something different. I knew nothing I could buy at GNC was going to help me out. And so I went on to, you know, the shady forums and like even stuff like bodybuilding.com and all that. And the first thing I ran across was the ephedrine T3, T4 stack. And so I researched it and at that time I had ran across clenbuterol and T3. But clenbuterol and T3, that was too much for me. That was too crazy. And so I started out with ephedrine and T3. And, you know, I sourced it from these questionably legal places and, you know, all these get arounds. And I started taking that, and once again, I see this increase where even though my diet's bad and all these other things are bad, like, I can still maintain weight loss with all these variables that I'm not willing to change. I'm not willing to work out less or more. I couldn't work out more even if I wanted to, and I'm not willing to change my diet. But, you know, I was noticing it pushed me past that plateau, and I started losing weight again.
Interesting. What was it like being on T3 and ephedrine?
It's interesting because the first couple times you take ephedrine, it's a pretty nasty experience because it's kind of like a stimulant that you don't really have any exposure to in any other context. It's not like caffeine, it's not like nicotine. So the first time you take ephedrine, it's pretty brutal. But in comparison to what I was doing to my body in, you know, a completely natural context of working out, I was able to kind of quickly push through it, and I wasn't having the same anxiety attacks. It was still cardiovascularly very uncomfortable and a lot of these other weird side effects. But, you know, ephedrine, at least in my experience, is like something the body kind of quickly adapts to. And that was one of the big issues, is because at first ephedrine's effective, but for me personally, my body adapted to it so quickly that, and also ephedrine is a regulated substance, so you can legally buy it, but you're only allowed to buy so much of it in a month, and that's tracked federally. And so I came up this wall where, like, I was only allowed so much ephedrine a month, and I was getting pretty quickly used to it. And so that's when I started kind of looking for other alternatives to ephedrine and T3. As far as being on T3, I can't really say any noticeable, like, psychological differences. I couldn't really pick up on anything like that.
Got it. And so what was the next step? Where did you look? And, you know, because, like, for me, I know that frustration. It's like, you know, I remember, like, even for, like, lifting, right, you would get stuck at, like, you know, benching, what, 275 or whatever. And it's like, no matter how hard you try, like, you know, 285 just doesn't happen. Like, every time you try it, you know, it like, the attempts go worse and worse. And, like, I remember losing weight, too. In 2012, I had given a go at it, and it just kind of, like, stopped at, like, 30 pounds lost. And it's like, you know, 6 weeks later, and you're at the same weight, and you're just like, what's going on, right? I've been doing more. I've been trying to eat less, and it's not going anywhere. So where did you turn to next?
Once again, I hit a pretty brutal plateau at 210. I couldn't push past 210 no matter what I did. The only times I would ever dip below 210 was just pure water weight. And so I went back to the same forms. And all of a sudden, because I was willing to take ephedrine in T3, I was willing to take that gamble, all of a sudden clenbuterol in T3, you know, it seemed like a mild step up. I'm not talking about, it went from jumping into something that, like, is legal but questionable for health, and then jumping into something where the legality and the dangerousness both drop down, or I guess, you know, the way you want to look at it, increases in risk, increases in, you know, the question of, you know, how ethical is this? And because I had already made that commitment to do ephedrine, jumping up to clenbuterol was almost a no-brainer. And everyone, and it's tough because the bodybuilding community, sometimes they have this way of challenging each other. And in some contexts, that is an amazing thing, like challenging you to push for a certain aesthetic or push for a certain goal. But, you know, when people were advocating for clenbuterol, you know, it was kind of this idea of, like, it's not really that dangerous, it's not really that bad, you know, it's great for weight loss, like, just suck it up kind of thing. And so once again, I kind of made that commitment to jump on the train wagon for clenbuterol and T3.
So what was clenbuterol like?
Oh, so clenbuterol is one of the most agonizing experiences I've ever put on. And it's difficult because, you know, you go to these same forms where people are giving you these schedules or these kind of, like, these amounts to take, and you know, ramping up and ramping down. And I remember the one I kind of settled on was seen as, like, conservative. And the final dose, I can't remember if it was milligrams or micrograms of clenbuterol, but was around 100, you know, let's say micrograms of clenbuterol. But at least in my personal experience, anytime you start pushing past 40 to 60, you're just bedbound, because the whole time you're having heart palpitations, you're having insane amounts of anxiety. It's nearly impossible to have a conversation with anyone. Once again, I was in school, and it became this thing that was difficult because, and also clenbuterol lasts forever. Ephedrine has a nice quick half-life. You take it, you feel most of its side effects, I would say, for me personally, 3 to 4 hours. Clenbuterol is a different monster. You're strapping into an experience where you feel like you're about to have a heart attack for 6, 7, 8 hours of just misery.
I hardly ever hear people saying that they're looking forward to taking Glenn.
Yeah, something we talked about in a pre-interview that maybe you could touch on a little bit more is the mechanism by which clenbuterol works is it affects a lot of other muscle systems that ephedrine doesn't really, in my experience, didn't really kind of interact with. And so one of the most difficult parts of clenbuterol is because it is such a powerful central nervous system stimulant, was just the way it affected heart, breathing, just the entire body stimulant.
Yeah, and it's I think they said that farmers use it in livestock sometimes to increase like muscle mass. And, you know, the beta 3 agonist. So beta is an adrenergic receptor, so adrenaline associated. And so typically like epinephrine, adrenaline, you know, they'll touch the beta receptors and also the alpha receptors. It's non-selective. But when we go to beta 3, you're starting to select. And so you can hit the smooth muscle, you can hit the skeletal muscle. And so, you know, that kind of stimulation can then affect the nervous system, which then moves somebody towards like a fight or flight mode and just makes the experience all that more difficult. And so DNP, how did you come across DNP?
So clenbuterol and T3 wasn't that effective. In general, I don't really advocate. People have asked me about that stack before. I think you're looking at marginal increases in weight loss. It's expensive, you know, it's really dangerous. The benefit it gives you is so easily compensated in diet changes or exercise changes. Overall, even though I was taking a lot of these chemicals, they weren't really helping me push past that magic 200 to get under that 200 and move towards, you know, the weight I was before. So once again, I turn back to these bodybuilding forms. And at that point, I had heard of DNP. But it wasn't really talked about. And I just saw it mentioned once in this random, you know, bodybuilder forum. Because on bodybuilding.com, you know, like, they stay away from pretty stigmatized chemicals for the most part. But someone had mentioned it, and I started looking up DNP. And it's insane because, you know, the stories you hear immediately are both extremes. You hear about people dying, but you hear about people losing 10, 15 pounds in the course of like a week or two. And then you have all these anecdotal stories of people saying they took DNP. And as with anything on the internet, it's pretty challenging because like there's no way to verify who is or isn't taking DNP. And then so I turned to YouTube. I looked at videos by, you know, I don't want to really name anyone by names, but I saw these people that would be like, hey, listen, like this could kill you. This may be dangerous, but I've taken it. I was able to navigate it. Plenty of people have been able to navigate it, like use at your own risk. And looking at everything in that place of desperation, seeing three or four different YouTubers at the time, all these forum posts of people being like, yeah, you know, DNP is tough to be on, but like I did it. It's fine. You'll be fine sort of thing. I decided to make the commitment and find a source for it.
And what was the experience of being on DNP like?
Oh, man. The way I describe this is there's no other way to describe it than feeling like you're in hell. With DNP, there's kind of four principles or pillars that make DNP use uncomfortable. The first one is heat. Your body is kicking off all this excess heat. I would commonly be in my room during the winter with the thermostat set to 60 with a giant fox fan blowing over me. And even in that state, I would sweat through my clothes and sweat through my sheets. At the time, I worked at a Texas roadhouse. And sometimes when I was on cycle, we had this industrial size freezer. And I would go stand in the industrial size freezer. And it would take 5 to 10 minutes before I felt any measure of cold. So that's just the sheer amount of heat your body's putting off. And with that heat comes sweating. So not only is all this, you know, metabolic activity producing a lot of water, but you're also really hot. And so one of the most uncomfortable experiences, both societally and personally, is you're just constantly sweating like you're in a sauna. And you can be in, like I said, I was in a 60 degree room with a box fan. I would sweat through my sheets. I would sweat through everything. And so what became really challenging is because, once again, I was in a lot of social situations. I was in college. I would sweat through my clothes in class. I would sweat through everything. And I'm not talking like pit stains. I'm talking sweat through the bottom of my shorts, the back of my shirt, sweat through everything. Or sweat beads running down my face in class. I remember one time we had a particularly cold winter while I was at Purdue. And so, you know, DMP, I guess, is mildly nice when it's like -3 out and you're trying to get to class. But the second I would step into these classrooms with the heat cranked up, I was profuse, like hair damp. And it was hard because there's a lot of social stigma around that, because like you look like you're on drugs because you are on a drug and you're having this experience that no one else is having. And it becomes pretty societally weird at first.
In the video that, you know, I wrote the script and I wanted to check the DNP part for like scientific accuracy. So I actually asked one of my peers who actually knew me from college to check it. And when they were reading through it, they said to me, "Weren't you like ultra sweaty during class like half the time in college?" And I was like, "Yeah, but I swear I wasn't taking this stuff." And like they were just kind of like giving me crap for it, just like laughing and saying like, because I remember when I did the powerlifting stuff, like at the peak, right? Like there was one winter where it was like, you know, Chicago Midwest winter, right? It was cold. It was, you know, wasn't even snow anymore just because it was that cold. And you were just drenched in sweat, right? And even though it's like it's cold outside, like you can actually see the heat like radiating like from me. I didn't even need to wear a jacket. I'm just like walking around in a hoodie and people are like looking at me strange. But, you know, so that sweating is such a stigma, because it's like then you're like drenched and there's like a ring around your collar of just like wet. And people are like looking at you like, "What's wrong with you, man?" Right?
And then the same with sweating. Once again, I never let up on the abusive amount of working out, which really elevated DMP use. Working out on DMP is really hard because you're exhausting all your carbohydrates, you're exhausting all your ATP. So to work out on DMP is just about sheer willpower. And at that point, it was sheer self-hate and self-loathing was the only thing that kind of pushed me forward with working out. But when I would work out, especially in a gym, like leaving literal puddles of sweat at like the deadlift station, all of my clothes completely drenched through, like I had jumped in a pool. And then the next kind of byproduct of any kind of combustion reaction or all this metabolic activity is CO2. So the other kind of difficult thing is I could be completely laying in bed and I would be panting. Literally panting, my body trying to get rid of this CO2, these really shallow and quick, like deep pants. So you're in these social interactions. I had my girlfriend at the time, she didn't really quite know what I was on. She knew I was on something. But every time I was around new friends, they'd be like, "Why are you breathing so hard? Why are you breathing like that?" Like literally like I just walked up a set of stairs, even though I'd been sitting completely still for hours.
So how long did you take DMP for?
Well, see, it's kind of tough because over this, from when I first discovered it and first bought it, I bought it in two different rounds. The first time I bought a really small amount and kind of went through that. When I first started taking DMP, I kind of followed the guidelines, right? Don't take it any longer than a week or 2 weeks. Stay kind of relatively conservative doses. And I did that. But what was hard was, you know, the results were so tempting, right? And it was just such an addictive feeling to raise my metabolism in this way that was not possible in any other context. And, you know, I kind of developed this strange form of bulimia where one of the unfortunate side effects is I would binge eat. And I started taking DMP, not necessarily to lose weight, but to counteract the calories I was eating. And one of the most difficult feelings of DMP is you have the heat, you have the sweating, you have the breathing, but the hunger. You have this insatiable and indescribable craving for simple sugars, for carbs, for anything. And what's challenging is the second you give your body something that's really easily broken down, like a simple sugar, it kind of puts that DMP machine into motion. And so I remember one time I went with my friend and I had ate some pasta at O'Charlie's. And the second you ingest any kind of carbs, you start profusely sweating and profusely generating heat. And so it's difficult because to kind of manage the side effects, you have to avoid certain foods. But those are precisely the foods you're craving, precisely the foods you have a desperation for. And it was tough because I would have these little 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 calorie meals, and no matter how much I ate, I was always hungry. Because by the way mechanism of DMP works, it's constantly telling your body that we don't have energy, we need more. And so one of the other difficult things, unfortunately, during my time, I had some close friends in the bodybuilding community, weight loss community, and I gave DMP to my friends. And everyone else I gave it to actually gained weight on DMP because... yes, you're increasing your metabolic activity, but the increase in hunger, if you don't have that dedication, it's ironic because the only people that could push through that hunger are precisely the people that don't need DMP because they're already so dedicated. And really the only reason I was able to lose weight despite, you know, binge eating all this other stuff was the sheer mercilessness I worked out. So it's tough because a lot of people have reached out to me and been like, you know, where can I find DMP? Is DMP effective? And it's hard for me to attribute. Yes, I took DMP and yes, it helped. But like I've known people who have gained weight on DMP. It's just crazy. It's pretty much utter agony. I've put my body through a lot of miserable experiences. But there's nothing that really kind of relates to that experience. And so back to your earlier question of how long I took it, I took it pretty consistently on and off for these week cycles for roughly like 3 to 4 months, and then I ran out. And I kind of took a break from it for a little while because it was kind of hard to find more. Sourcing actual DMP is a really difficult process, not something I'm ever willing to talk about. But so it took me a while before I could get back. But the thing that's difficult is I would also, one of the other reasons I advocate against DMP use for weight loss is I think an apt metaphor is taking testosterone to gain muscle. Testosterone and DMP are tools. And, you know, in the right context, sure, they can do amazing things for your body. They're supplementing and raising your body to this superhuman level of, you know, whether it's protein synthesis, whether it's metabolic activity. But the downside, as many people know with testosterone, is the second you remove that superhuman aspect, all your gains start to fade away. And it's the same with, you know, fat loss. Is yes, you will lose weight, but one of the craziest thing I noticed is that my body's eagerness to replace that fat I lost almost in probably twice the amount of time it took to lose it. So like say I lost X amount of weight in a week on DMP, I would gain that weight back in 2 weeks. Because once again, one of the things I was refusing to do was address my diet. And so in the same way, people get into these tricky positions where they become behaviorally addicted or dependent on steroid use. I became very behaviorally and dependent on DMP use to even not only lose weight but maintain the weight loss I had lost.
The day of September 3rd, 2015, what do you remember happening?
It's challenging because, so there's a couple things happening around that time period. I had recently started up a cycle again, and at that point I was pretty consistently on and off DMP for about 8 to 6 months. I was really struggling with body dysmorphia at the time, and I went through this phase where all of a sudden I felt really fat. Even though I was extremely lean at the time, even though I was in one of the best shapes I'd ever been, I got it into mind that like I needed to keep pushing, I needed to keep losing weight, so I upcycled. Up until that point, I had been very careful about weighing out my DMP, making sure when I took it. But I had been doing it so long, I was getting to the point where I could, you know, fairly reasonably eyeball my dosage because I'd done it so frequently. But I had recently upregulated the amount I was taking. And so I think it was a combination of upregulating is also a very hot September. And so I took a dose and I remember immediately feeling awful. And so I decided to go to bed. And somewhere in that time period, I woke up and I think in confusion due to heat exhaustion or something was going on with this DMP, I was kind of delirious and kind of out of my mind and not really knowing what was going on. When I woke up, it was still light out. And because I'd slept through the night, I'd gone to bed maybe like in the middle of the afternoon. And so I thought I was much further along in my dose than I was. And I re-upped kind of in that 12-hour window. And for those that don't know, you know, the kind of the window in which DMP is active is somewhere in the order of 24 to 36 hours. And so when you take that dose too soon, you're moving that kind of effective dose that you're on up dramatically. And one of the most important things I kind of want to highlight with DMP use, at least in my personal experience, is there's not a linear relationship to the misery of your side effects and the dose you're taking. So like say you have, you know, some sort of experience at 50 milligrams, it's not double that experience when you take 100 milligrams, it's almost triple that. So it's more of this kind of polynomial curve where like the more you're taking, like the side effects ramp significantly. That combination of overdosing, having some still in my system, it quickly pushed me radically into this dangerous zone.
Got it. And what do you remember happening after that, or do you not remember much? Like what were some of the details that were told to you of that day?
Thanks to the details. So a lot of this is going to be secondhand. For instance, there's a lot of things don't make sense. They found my wallet 2 miles from my house on the day I had overdosed. I don't know where I went. I don't remember any of that. I don't know if I tried to go on a run. I don't know why I took my wallet with me. They found my ID literally 2 miles from my house. And I came back, and the one memory I have, I vaguely remember taking the second dose and being confused. And the next solid memory I have before I wake up in the hospital is being completely naked in my shower with it set to as cold as it can be. And so I'm in the shower, I'm kind of in pain, I'm groaning, I'm not doing well, the door's wide open. My brother-in-law kind of walks by and immediately notices something is wrong. He's trying to talk to me. And all I would get out is, get me Coca-Cola and a milkshake from Steak and Shake. Because at this point, my body is ravaging every store of energy I have. I'm already very lean. I don't really have much fat to feed it. My muscles and my body are completely depleted of any carbohydrates. And I was so desperate for simple sugars. I kept on being like, I need Coca-Cola and a milkshake. I'll be fine. And he went out and got it. But by the time he came back, I had lost responsiveness. And so he calls the paramedics. By the time the paramedics get there the first time, I have no memory of this. This is just all accounts from my brother-in-law. I'm responsive enough to answer kind of the status quo questions of who's president, what year is it, what day is it, sort of thing. And so I send them away. I wouldn't go with them. I was under the assumption that ownership of DMP is illegal. I was also worried about some other things. I was also very stubborn, so to admit that I was in any kind of danger was difficult. And also, I didn't really want to incur that financial cost of an ambulance ride. And so I sent them away. But once again, I lost consciousness. And once again, my brother-in-law finds me. And he calls the paramedics a second time. And luckily, one of the details I didn't really cover in my video is that my brother-in-law, who lived in the house with me, my sister was living kind of separately, but her best friend and roommate was like an Army Ranger medic. And so they were literally on the phone with this medic, and he was like, whatever he says, it doesn't matter. You need to get him to the hospital. And so the second time the paramedics came around, they picked me up and took me to the hospital. The way I make light of this is it sort of sucks because I always wanted to go on an ambulance ride, but it's one of those things that's difficult because, you know, you don't ever want to be in an ambulance, but I don't remember that at all. And they took me to the hospital, and that's when events quickly kind of just spiral at that point.
And you had mentioned in the video, so basically nothing in the emergency room and the transfer to the intensive care unit you remember, right?
It's tough because the stories I heard of me are so unlike me. I'm generally a pretty nice person. I don't really like to put people out of their way. I'm from the Midwest. And so I was cussing out nurses. I was telling doctors, like, get away from me. It got to the point where I was combative. I was trying to fight to leave. I was trying to pull out IVs. Eventually, when things were starting to get more serious, I tried to pull out my central line, which is a huge no-no. And so at first they tried to restrain me, but I would not tell them what I was on. I was lucid. I was having conversations. I was understanding questions, but I don't remember any of it from my first arrival to the hospital, talking to the paramedics, talking to doctors. I don't have any memory of it.
In the report, it wrote that on, I think, hospital day 3 or 4, you were extubated, which means that you must have regained consciousness and pulled the tube out of your throat yourself. Usually they let the patients do that. And like the moment you wake up, you're like, what is this thing? And you pull it out. Do you remember like that moment when you woke up? Because some patients don't, because they're still, you know, sedated under medicines. Do you remember that moment? Or do you remember like the next like 45 minutes to a couple hours afterwards?
I remember the exact moment I woke up. It's kind of a running joke in my family because I woke up and my sister was there, Margaret, and she was kind of crying because they kept on telling my family they were going to wake me up. But then, you know, when they first put me under, of course, things got to the point where they were telling my family I was going to die and to say their goodbyes. And then I kind of passed the threshold where my life was out of, like, no longer was I gonna die, but we don't really know what's gonna happen. And so they eventually kind of made the decision to wake me up from my medically induced coma. And I remember waking up and seeing my sister, and everything was so strange because I was still heavily sedated even though they were waking me up. And my feet were really swollen and my hands were swollen. I had like everything around was a weird color. And I remember looking at my feet and starting to cry. And I was like, because they didn't look real. They weren't the color of skin. They were ballooned up. And I was like, are those my real feet? And that's the first thing I asked. And my sister was like, yeah, those are real feet. And I was like, for some reason, I decided they were going to take my feet. I was like, promise, those are my real feet. Don't let them take my feet. And there was never any moment where, like, amputation was, like, anything that was up for discussion. But I didn't even know why I was in the hospital. It would have been different had I remembered some of these details leading up, but at that point, I didn't even really remember overdosing. I just wake up, I'm in this place, I don't know what's going on, I can't move. That's another thing, is I couldn't lift my arm, I couldn't move my legs. I thought I was paralyzed temporarily because I was so incredibly weak. I took everything just to kind of turn my head to the side.
Yeah, what was the physical therapy like after the ICU?
I think one of the most bittersweet ironies to this was the physical therapy aspect. Here I am, you know, pushing so hard to have this body and pushing myself in all these ways. And then during my overdose, a lot of my muscles were so incredibly badly damaged, either partially like cannibalized or some other kind of mechanisms that are a little bit outside of my understanding. But suffice it to say, you know, I couldn't lift my arms. I couldn't do anything. I had to relearn how to walk. It took forever to stand. I had no strength. I went from this person that was so strong and could run miles and miles and lift weights and all these things. I go from this place of being incredibly strong to being so indescribably weak. And it's so embarrassing because there's a lot of moments in the hospital I can't go to the bathroom by myself, but I have to have nurses help me. And I had to relearn how to walk. It took me about a month and a half to the point where I could walk any kind of considerable distance. It took me several months to get to the point where I could even go for a jog. It took me over 6 months to get to a point where I could even lift weights. I went from such a high to such a low so quick, and it was such a detriment to my identity and who I was in every respect. A lot of the physical therapy was focusing on regaining my lung capacity. That was another thing. I lost a lot of lung function that I ultimately got back. There was questions and concerns because of the heat about cognitive functions. It's hard to tell to this day whether my cognitive functions were strongly affected. For the most part, I feel like I'm fine. Yeah. So physical therapy was a lot of band training, a lot of trying to throw myself back into lifting any kind of weights. And just as perspective, it went from being this place where I could deadlift 500 pounds to where lifting a 10-pound dumbbell up to my sides was a monumental task.
Yeah, I've always had this theory thinking that it's like the years that you turn 22 and 26, those are like kind of like two like events, like it could be good, could be bad, but something happens to you that you just kind of like, you change a little bit, right? And so like 22 was like, for me, that was like one of the first ones because I got hit by a car that year, twice actually. Then 26, I remember like everything just changing again. And so like I've always had this theory that those are the 2 years that kind of like usher people into like early life to adulthood. In that light, how did the event change your relationship with the gym and the fitness? And how has that relationship evolved to what it is today?
I mean, the first thing is waking up and being hit with this sledgehammer or this huge realization that I nearly died. Coupled with the weakness, coupled with all these things, coupled with all these lines in my body and these pictures my family was telling me and my family telling me that they had to say goodbye. Another kind of unfortunate and tragic detail is I had just started dating someone, and our 1 month, you know, first anniversary was during the peak of when they said they were going to have to go. So this new girlfriend I have is potentially saying her last goodbyes on what was supposed to be our first month together. And so the first kind of thing was waking up from that experience. And in general, kind of the details, but my life was kind of going downwards at that point. I had flunked out of college. I was really struggling. I had always seen myself as an engineer. I didn't want to do that anymore. I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I put all my value and all my sense of worth in my body and fitness. And so after that, I had this new lease on life. I had literally almost died for something so silly and so dumb as even though to me it made sense. It was about the death of my father and about all these other aspects. Still, even in that context, it was that wake-up call. It was this moment I needed to regain the desire to want to live. And I took it and I ran with it. I completely turned my life around. And I just didn't care about fitness for a while. Of course, it's kind of difficult because I got into this relationship with someone with their own relationship with eating and fitness and stuff that was pretty unhealthy. But for a long time, I kind of detached from it. It was something I still loved, something I still did, but I didn't see my value in my body anymore during that period of my life.
To someone who might be thinking of DNP, to someone who might be have a different backstory, but be in kind of like a similar situation, what is your suggestion to them? Would you suggest them take DMP? And then two, if you could go back in time, you would tell yourself, like, how would you have done things differently?
I just want to really highlight how I shouldn't be alive today. Had I lived alone, I would have been dead. Had my brother-in-law just left me alone in the shower, I would have been dead. Had I just gone up to my room instead of going into the shower, I wouldn't be here. The only reason I'm here is a set of, you know, kind of fortunate events. For instance, I wouldn't tell the doctors I was on DMP. Finally, my brother reached out and told them in the nick of time. And so the biggest thing I kind of want to advocate here is that, like, you know, so many people die from this drug and don't have the opportunity to tell this story. I'm sure there's a lot of people that take it, you know, safely and have good experiences with it, but it's such a gamble and it's such a risk. And one of the things we kind of talked about in our, you know, pre-interview is that there's no antidote to DMP. The second you take DMP, you're strapping yourself into experience that has to run its course. Now, there is a drug that kind of like plays a part, maybe, and it addresses some of the side effects. But one of the most important things is I talk about is like when you go into the ER with a knife wound, a gunshot wound, like all those medical professionals know what they're dealing with. They know how to save your life. You go in and you won't tell the doctors you're on DMP. They've never even heard of DMP before. You're putting yourself at a significant disadvantage to getting medical care. And the other thing is, yes, DMP is this super, you know, kind of tempting idea of radical weight loss. But it's interesting because if you are the kind of person that like struggles to lose weight in other ways, like there's the extreme hunger that you'll experience with DMP. There's the misery that you'll experience with DMP. So it's not nearly the promised miracle chemical that you're believing it. I strongly advocate to create healthier relationships with your body, create healthier relationships with your mind, explore weight loss in terms of changing things for the better. And that's what will lead to sustainable and healthy, you know, kind of change in your body.
Chris, thank you so much for sharing the story. I remember when you reached out to me, I watched your whole video in its entirety. Like, I think it's 45 plus minutes. And I remember thinking in my mind, you know, the experiences that you described, obviously our backstories are different, but kind of the mindsets from what I remember when I was in college and, you know, having that, you know, that mindset about the gym, having that mindset about, you know, one's self-image and then, you know, just kind of like the stress that can come up from the environment. And for me, like it just kind of reminded me of so much. And then I looked at your whole channel and it reminded me of like my 2016 videos. And I like it almost like even the lighting and everything. And I was just thinking, you know, this is like at the very minimum, it's an experience that like, because I can't relate 100% to the backstory, I can relate somewhat to the experience of in between. And just thinking, especially in context of toxicology, it was, you know, such a great story to hear that you're able to come out and that you're making a YouTube channel and that you're talking about all the self-improvement and everything that has come up, but also as like a creative outlet with some of your spoken words. You know, just yeah. There's just so much beautiful work on there. And I think there's so much potential on there. And I'm excited to see as time goes on, all the different things that you develop.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. And I think one of the coolest aspects of this is just how full circle it is. When someone originally put forth your name, I recognized it and I went to your channel and saw your more recent body of work and I didn't really recognize it. And I scroll and then I see some thumbnails I used to watch all the way back in the day when you first put out videos. And it's interesting because I watched your videos when I was trying to lose weight and your experience of the way you were navigating it and stuff like that. And so to have this full circle and share a similar experience on a channel I remember so clearly, you know, years ago now has been honestly really cool. And I want to thank you for the opportunity.
Awesome. Thanks. Yeah, no, it's great to hear because it's like, you know, things have gone so long for me on YouTube now. To see, you know, there's people now who may have said, oh, I remember the videos from, you know, 2016 or 2015 even, right? You know, I'm glad to hear your story and that, you know, everything is going very well for you now. And just seeing your body of work, I see so much potential in it. And, you know, I'm so excited to see what comes next.
Appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.